Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Welcome to Junctional Thinking on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Pierre Vigilance. My career path has taken me through medical and public health training to leadership positions in the nonprofit, government, and academic sectors, as well as now advisory consulting. And on that journey, I've gained an appreciation for the concept that health is about more than medicine and healthcare. And it's really outside of what healthcare can reasonably be expected to provide. It takes diverse, innovative partnerships to positively impact health outcomes. So this podcast is a place where we get to explore the creative problem-solving opportunities and innovations that exist at The Junction, a place I define as the intersection of health and social impact interventions. Each episode will be joined by guests from a range of sectors, with the commonality between them being that they all have some impact on health. So from community engagement, user experience and creativity, to housing, transportation, journalism, education, finance, and healthcare, we'll delve into the ways these innovative influencers seek to impact social and health outcomes from their own unique perspectives. And today I'm really, really happy to be joined in the studio by a gentleman who has been around the district for a while now. I like to call him a tastemaker. We're just getting to know each other a little bit, but he's a bit of a tastemaker. His name is Rock Branch. He is the founder and managing partner at Inside Urban, and he's going to talk to us a bit about that. But I just want to say thank you for agreeing to join me in here.
Thanks for having me, brother.
Good opportunity to chop it up a little bit and sort of talk about some of these impact-oriented things. Because I know we've been talking recently, impact has been a word that you have used many, many times. Right. And so just if you want to just introduce yourself to the people and then we can get into this conversation.
Sure. Thanks for having me again. My name is Rockman Branch, and like you said, I'm the managing partner of Inside Urban, which is a small local firm here consisting of educators, behavioral health, social, emotional service providers, some financial literacy folk, really with the idea of tapping into the different opportunities that we know our most underserved residents have been receiving, and find ways to help government have greater alignment towards the service component of the work they look to do with the residents, and really turning the mindset from, you know, doing something for a people to doing something with a people.
Wow. Okay. No. And I say wow because in an earlier episode of this podcast, to sit down and talk with a friend who does some design thinking work, mm-hmm. human-centered design work, and that's the basic premise there, which is too often we and others who are creating things mm-hmm. create things for people right. as opposed to creating things with them. And when we create for, we create from our perspective, right. not from the perspective of the person who's actually going to be using the product or taking advantage of the service that we say we want them to take right. advantage of.
Because the for actually becomes a to after a while.
Right.
So instead of you doing something for people, now you're doing something to them.
Right.
And without their buy-in, it becomes an adverse relationship. So
right.
really changing the mindset on how we serve.
Yes. You know? Yes. And so let's just get into that a bit then. Mm-hmm. So as you have over the course of your time, and you've done some different things in your career, right? And so you've learned from a few different types of experience.
Right.
As a learner, and it seems like you're a perpetual learner because mm-hmm. this is a new step for you. How do you get influenced? What do you sort of say is your method of learning, and how do you use that in moving you forward and getting into what you're doing right now?
Great question. A lot of it is, you know, being self-taught or being an initiative taker around my own learning. So I try to read as much as I can, which is not nearly as much as I like to, right. but as much as I can. And ultimately making sure I'm in the spaces and places really learning from the people who I want to serve right. and serve properly. So we often believe that folks don't have much to offer in the space of how can you learn to support them or how can you learn to be a help to them. But that's probably the place we need to start. So I spend a lot of time in the communities that I want to serve, really making sure I always have my finger on the pulse of what's being requested and what the opportunities are in various communities so that, you know, populations can experience living their best life as well.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of my learning is done on the ground and in the spaces. I've always been considered a practitioner and probably not enough of a theorist, but I learned the practical reality often supports every assessment that I come up with.
Right, right. You're reminding me now, when you start talking about being practice or applied learning versus theory, and you know, I spent a bit of time in academia, still do some work in the academic space, and I get in trouble because you know, a lot of times we talk a lot about the theory, the hypothetical, and how might one do X, Y, or Z, but then actually getting in and engaging and doing it, completely different set of skills. You talk about going into places and trying to get to know the people that you are going to serve right. or trying to serve. What have been some of the challenges that you have had in trying to do that? I know you were a principal here in the right. District of Columbia for a bit, in a public school here right. in DC. So I've got to be clear on that. And that has its own set of challenges yeah. and issues to it. But there or in any other space?
So my career in DC began in the youth development, after-school programming space. I worked for nonprofits and moved through the ranks of a few different nonprofits, became the executive director of one here in the district, and really began to put my arms around the fact that there's a lot more that I needed to learn when it came to engaging populations. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that the biggest reset button, if you will, was my tenure as assistant principal and principal at Ballou High School. You know, having done most of my work in the Northwest area around the Park Morton community, a little bit in the Lincoln Heights community in Northeast, moving into Southeast DC, it taught me one really big lesson. And what that was is something that I always knew but had real problems trying to articulate it. And it comes down to the fact that government and agencies, if you will, have very low credit with, you know, a lot of people of color. Mm. They just don't have good credit with the community. I had to recognize that as a principal of a high school, I was being looked at as a government agency and a person of the government and not necessarily a principal. And so all the different isms and all of the, you know, the tension around those relationships were being projected into the relationships that I was having with residents. And so really I had to stand the test of time. The biggest thing I had to learn was always be present and be consistently present. And that's the way that community over, you know, I was there for a decade, but it took about 3 years before they began to trust me, trust that I would be in the community, trust that I'm not, you know, going to get a promotion and transfer in a year. Right. So why get attached to working with me on improvements when they believe that my presence wouldn't last? And then after about 3 years, when they realized that I had every intention to stay, the remainder of that decade was pretty awesome. And we had some real great successes.
It's fantastic. We are on the air, Full Service Radio, the Junctional Thinking Podcast, with a guest today. Our guest today is Rachman Branch, founder and managing partner at Insight Urban. And you're just talking a bit about two key elements, which is, you know, consistency piece of things, being Absolutely. Consistently engaged in order to be able to gain the trust of mm-hmm. the people that you are working with mm-hmm. and ultimately serving. And you learning to do that, were those difficult lessons for you to learn? Or did you come out of a space that already had that yeah. sort of hardwired into you? You knew you were going to have to do it.
So I pretty much knew I had to do it. I'm originally from Newark, New Jersey, which is not very different from Southeast DC, mm-hmm. and recognizing what life was like growing up there mm-hmm. and the relationship that we had with government. You know, I just kind of put myself in the same scenario, remembering this is, you know, and, you know, Newark, New Jersey, most people don't know, was the last city that was lifted from under martial law. You know, after 68, when the King riots happened, tanks were in Newark until 71.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, everyone grew up with this real, you know, this real concern around how government moves and interacts with population. So being born just a year after that, you know, our community was still very much aware of how we engage community. And so I think I carried that with me. I think I was hardwired as a result of that.
Okay.
To think community-minded first.
Okay.
You know, and that's where, you know, even transitioning into the mayor's office, that's where my focus came from. I always looked at it as, you know, I just happen to be, you know, connected to the woman who won the opportunity to serve. And I think that's where the work that I did in that office versus maybe some of my colleagues comes from, is that I always looked at it as a service job.
Okay.
So where people would often say, you know, we work for the mayor, you know, with no disrespect to the mayor, because I love her to death, I would always respond, no, we work for the people, you know. And if we're mindful of the fact that, you know, if you want to say we work for the mayor, the next sentence should be, and the mayor works for the people.
Right.
You know, but, you know, I often found that, you know, the politics transition, I learned that reality and mm-hmm. how, you know, what the nature of compromise and politics are to service, you know. So I learned a lot there as well. But it always comes down to the individuals, you know, recognizing their responsibility to be of service.
And drilling down to that. Mm-hmm. So I know that we had, and referring back to another great conversation we had in this studio with somebody who does, Eric Letzinger, who does social impact mm-hmm. bond work. Mm-hmm. And we were chatting about, you know, not forgetting. Right. You can easily be in a room having a conversation about a program or a great idea that somebody in the room came up with or may have come from community, but then you can easily forget where it came from or who it's actually for. And that gets me to pivot actually to from the learning piece in general and learning from community to who specifically do you listen to? Are there characteristics of people or sources that you are particularly attentive to, mm-hmm. or are you sort of open up to just listening to anybody and everybody?
Well, you know, I can learn pretty much from anywhere. So as long as I'm being attentive and being open-minded about my position in different moments, I can learn from anywhere. I do have certain mentors in various strains in my life who have done the same work that I did around education, who have a background in service similar to my time with the mayor, who have nonprofit experience. So I do glean certain, you know, specific lessons from certain leaders. I actually learned a lot in my conversations with the mayor herself, just around her philosophy on serving and how to serve, you know, when you have people with multiple interests, multiple differing interests,
right,
and how to still serve there, how to help people find a happy medium in those moments. You know, by design, I went to a training on how to become a mediator just so I could really learn. I actually went to get trained and licensed as a mediator so I can really learn how to help people reach, you know, the happy medium for themselves and not necessarily for my end game, but
right,
how am I getting, you know, competing interest at the table to find commonality and work in that space.
Can we dig into that for a second?
Absolutely.
Because I find that some of my colleagues, even myself, some of the students that I've had the pleasure and honor of being able to sort of engage in mm-hmm. learning, we're very clear or very sure on what we think we know about something mm-hmm. and bring something to the table and say, well, here are my three ideas. And when all of them get shot down, we're sort of like, what happened? I thought that these were the best things, and we get personally offended.
Yeah.
But you just described being somebody who was willing to listen to other folks and bring people together to a place that you may have already mm-hmm. thought that they should be at,
mm-hmm.
but they may have gotten to through a process that you took them through. So mm-hmm. what is that like? What is the delta for you? But moderation mm-hmm. training and then after moderation training, what was the biggest change for you?
I think, you know, exponentially what grew for me was the understanding that, you know, being of service is that I'm really leaving a product with people that I'll probably not have to utilize.
Mm.
And so then I have to realize as I'm developing it, it's not for me or my needs, which really speaks to it not being of my reality.
Right.
So that means I have to be informed by the reality of the people who I'm building this for, or who I'm building this with, rather. So as I leave that resource, whatever it is that we create, it's of good use for the people who we leave it to. And not to say, you know, which I've seen in different circles, you know, I did my best. Oh, well, you guys aren't ready for this stage.
Right.
Well, then build the stage that we know they're ready for.
Yes. I like to call that, it's not an official term by any stretch of the imagination, but it's the what I call the yoga mat phenomenon. So you know, yoga's good for you. Right. So, and I do yoga. Mm-hmm. So, hey, I'm going to bring a yoga mat, and this is what's going to help you with your stress.
Right.
Yes, but not really. Right. If that's not my context for stress reduction, and if that's not the thing that's going to get me to where you think I need to go, maybe it's just me having easier access to transportation, or something else. There's nothing to do with my context and the yoga mat. So
I sat on a committee, a task force here in the district to address attendance for students, school attendance. Mm-hmm. And this is why I served under the mayor. And I remember a conversation, and around the table were probably, you know, 30 different agencies with every acronym or that whole glossary of positions, you know, all sitting around the table with all the letters behind their name. And I remember someone saying, we just have to get these young people to understand, you know, why it's important to go to school every day. And just that morning I left Wellington Park, which is a housing facility in Southeast DC, where I was in a house where there were mushrooms growing out the ceiling.
Wow.
And so in the meeting, I get very emotional about it. I'm like, you know, we're missing the mark.
Right.
Because if you walk into that community where they've said on record to anyone who listened, 35% of our residents have respiratory issues because of the conditions we live in.
Yes.
So if my job is to convince my son who can't breathe today, he still needs to go to school, whose job is to make sure I don't have mold and mushrooms growing in my apartment?
Amen. Right.
And so we're still pushing them to have this intrinsic value of education, but the days I miss it because I literally cannot breathe. And I can't breathe because this slumlord has not been addressed. And so if we as government, you know, to raise our credit in poor communities, if we did our part, which was legislate and prosecute the slumlord,
fix that,
then we have a little more weight to come to mom and say, now Billy needs to get to school on time.
Right, because I've taken care of some of these basic environmental day to day. You're in school, but X number of hours per day, you come home to this and impacted by it negatively every single day and all weekend. So the
yoga mat of the incentives that we offer, like, hey, we'll give you, you know, breakfast at IHOP. Well, no, I still can't breathe. So, you know, I'm missing school because of something greater than myself.
Yes. This is great. So we are on Full Service Radio here with Rachman Branch, the founder and managing partner at Inside Urban. We're going to start a bit of a conversation about, I want to come back to that piece about partnering a bit later on, because the mushrooms from the ceiling is definitely a visual image I want everyone to sort of just hold on to and press pause on. But just want to start a conversation about leadership. And when you're talking about being at the table with all these leaders, in quotation marks, or even talking to community leaders, how do you view leadership with respect to creating impact?
Mm-hmm. So for me, it always started, and I, you know, one of the things I did in government, I always told people that, you know, I reference my experiences as a principal, because being a high school principal, I had an identified budget, I did my identified amount of staff, and I knew who the population I was charged with impacting was. And so I was very focused. And as the principal, a lot of times you have a certain level of autonomy, but can still provide great lessons around how you led. So I always use those stories. But I just talk about the necessity of having, you know, parents and students as a part of my leadership team. So my leadership team consisted of about, you know, with a staff of 160 and 1,400 children we were serving. Mm-hmm. We made sure that our leadership team, it was a robust 15-person group. And we made sure that we had three parents as a part of it, and we had two students as a part of it. Because if the job was for student learning to increase, there are all these other things as a high school principal, especially in urban settings, even more especially in poor urban settings, that you have to be mindful of, because it's not just about reading, writing, and arithmetic. Mm-hmm. Right? So, you know, we had to make sure that we were always being mindful of the realities. I had a gentleman named Ron Moten and another man named Jahar Abraham, the Pizzaholics,
who
came to my school every day for 18 months before they started, you know, earning a check to really be a part of what this leadership looked like. So I had to start by deferring to the talent in the room. If I saw something that someone can contribute, I had to defer to that expertise and allow them to be as great as they can be. And it's funny because while you hear it in hip hop vernacular and you hear it in songs, we used to say at our school, you know, to one another in our leadership team, you have to let me be great,
right.
You know, and because your greatness, you know, results into great wins for our children. So, you know, whenever we saw pushback or we saw someone getting their toes stepped on, we actually used that phrase, let me be great. You know, because we had to recognize that, you know, the talents, the leadership couldn't, I couldn't make every decision. I couldn't tackle every task. I rarely pulled pretty much any lever. I had to make sure that I'm managing a group of people who are doing that.
Okay.
From our instructional staff to our behavior staff, we started a nonprofit that raised nearly $18 million. So I had to trust people who were experts in these areas. You know, and then I had a fourth person who actually helped us get, you know, what was initially an $8 million building renovation to turn that into a $147 million new build. Those are all things, those are all tremendous levers that have, I had to trust the team, encourage them, make sure it still moves towards our charge, but really trust them to move.
Right, right. My takeaway from what you're saying, and correct me if you feel like this is a misrepresentation of what you just described, but in order for you to lead, you had to essentially put yourself in a position of following.
Absolutely.
You had to say, look, I don't know everything. I don't know all the ins and outs of all these different elements.
Right.
There are some things that I am going to be the person who knows the most in the room, mm-hmm. but there are many other spaces where I'm not, either because of my lived experience or my sector expertise or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, you humbled yourself and also led from a position that wasn't necessarily this traditional out front position,
right.
but maybe off to the side or behind or providing right. the resources. So I think that that's a big takeaway, mm-hmm. because a lot of times we think of leadership as being something that is about being out front
right.
or on top of a pyramid or
right.
something like that, or driving other people to do things. Sometimes it's about putting them in position to be great
yep.
and letting them be great, letting them do what they have to do.
You know, we learned a lot about, you know, we did all the different strength finders and Myers-Briggs, and we did all those things because we wanted to really get to know one another. But one of the things our team recognized in our dynamic was, you know, one of the things that Mr. Branch, that's what they referred to me, as they said, well, Mr. Branch, you're excellent at, you know, getting people on board, moving the message. Strength finder calls it the woo component. You know, so I was always given, you know, you can get anyone on board. And so I think, you know, serendipitously, me becoming the principal lent to me being able to say the right word or, you know, ingratiate myself to the right person to get the resource that now my expert team can execute with.
Right.
And so,
right.
you know, and I, it's like the old phrase, whenever I says, you know, you hire people who are smarter than you. I literally took that to heart.
And that's what you did. That's what you did. This is great. This is great. So this is Pierre Vigilance. You are on Full Service Radio, the Junctional Thinking Podcast. Our guest today is Rockman Branch, founder and managing partner at Inside Urban. We are going to get into a conversation, come back to the mushrooms on the ceiling in a minute. We're going to get into a conversation about partnerships and patience in a few short minutes, and we'll be back with you for that.
The track you're listening to during this break is by artist Kido. That's K-I-E-D-O. If you're tuned in, this is Full Service Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Junctional Thinking on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Pierre Vigilance, and I am joined by Rachman Branch, founder and managing partner at Inside Urban. We've been having a really great conversation about a few different things, but this sort of following in order to lead, for one thing, having great people around you, letting them be great. I appreciated your commentary about Peaceaholics and how, you know, they leaned in, and this is sort of their mode of operation. Sort of they have great intentionality about being in a space and trying to understand it and not just saying, hey, look, we know this because this is where we're from, and right. So you should do this.
Right.
And so, you know, shout out to them because I think they're still doing good stuff in the district.
Mm-hmm. They're still working.
But we wanted to then sort of get back around to this very telling image that I have in my head of, you know, mushrooms on the ceiling. And I mean, when we're not talking about like a psychedelic video
right.
at this point, we're talking about real life, mm-hmm. moisture in walls, allowing for mold to grow to an extent that there are literally, there's vegetation growing in people's homes. It's not in pots.
Right.
And what that means with respect to the air quality, et cetera, and coming from the health perspective, you know, this intersection of housing and health yeah. is one that is no more clearly defined than by these respiratory type concerns. And how can a child be expected to be in school and attentive all day when they spent a few hours late at night in the emergency department getting
yep.
nebulizer treatments
yep.
for an asthma exacerbation that was caused by mold, which was caused by a leaky roof that wasn't fixed, et cetera, et cetera? We could go down that rabbit hole.
That they're going back to tonight.
Right. That they're going back, right. That they're going back to tonight. And how does that feel to be going back to that space? If you go to a restaurant, you didn't like it, you don't go back to that restaurant.
Right.
But this is not the reality for people with respect to their housing.
Mm-hmm.
Inside Urban, as we talked about a little bit off the air, is looking to do some work at a couple of different intersections. You've got the education piece, the financial literacy piece, you've got the mental health piece. And, you know, how did you decide that those were the spaces that you wanted to try to intersect in order to be impactful?
So, great question. When I worked for the mayor, I was the director of the mayor's office on African American affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And we were charged with looking at five different things: education, health and wellness, crime and criminal justice, housing and economic opportunity. Quite frankly, drilled down, it looked like a very simple statement that we always used. You know, how do we make D.C., you know, appealing to African Americans like maybe North Chicago is, or you know, parts of Atlanta is? We want to make sure that, one, you can have a job that pays you a satisfying wage
mm-hmm.
that will allow you to purchase a home as a result of that job, mm-hmm. and that you have schools you can send your children to. So ultimately within that, you know, a suitable home, you want to make sure community is addressed and the crime and criminal justice in the neighborhood is intact so that you can feel safe where you live. And ultimately, you want to make sure, as most of these families that we're looking to support, we want them to naturally be healthy and thriving and well families. And so, you know, in my role as the director of African American Affairs, really pushing that issue, I saw spaces where we could execute well in collaboration with government agencies. But then I also saw lots of gaps that we have. And those gaps are a result of, you know, certain innovations that maybe we didn't take. And I find that, you know, just on a general level, government is always last at the table on innovation.
Right.
Just simply the private sector innovates exponentially quicker, and government, you know, governments are still doing pitch competitions, right? You know, like it's a new thing. So, you know, that's no slight. That's the reality of being big. Government moves
yes.
slower to innovation. And so Inside Urban was my opportunity to look at, you know, how we can be innovative with some key partnerships, innovative with some program directors of different agencies, and really try to move the needle in those same areas of education, housing, et cetera, for the sake of the populations who are in the district who aren't experiencing the kind of success that, you know, many of other folks are experiencing. So quite frankly, black and brown people, you know, how do we make sure they win?
And how do you, especially there are market forces that are impacting cities mm-hmm. across the country, a general move, it's safe to say, for people back into cities.
Mm-hmm.
cities have become more attractive places to live, not just D.C., but Baltimore, Philadelphia, Chicago, all these Atlanta, cities, et cetera. And as a result of that, though, there have been changes in communities that are, frankly, financial. They're economic changes, right? There's Philadelphia has incentivized development in different parts of the city where folks didn't want to be before, but now houses are popping up all over the place, and communities are changing. Some would say not necessarily for the better, but certainly for the richer, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And we are part of that. I can't sit here and act like I'm not part of that situation. How do you figure out how to make those changes equitable and sustainable and affordable for everybody so that there isn't some of the displacement, or we can at least try to mitigate some of the displacement that we've seen?
So, you know, in my official capacity, you know, I saw lots of opportunities where the district, again, in an attempt to be innovative, could look at programs, legislation, you know, funding for certain housing, you know, realities for certain, you know, economic development opportunities. And we moved on some of those things, right? So we're seeing the mayor be diligent about, you know, grants for, you know, addressing food desert issues. We've seen her, you know, respond to the Housing Production Trust and pumping more money into that so that there's a greater nest egg for affordable housing, ownership, et cetera. But, you know, one of the things that I like to do most in still having that concept of working with the community is reminding, because I'm not in the position to empower them, but to remind people of their power. And what that looks like is really helping poor communities understand transactional politics. And what I mean by that is, you know, recognizing that the example of how the new Baloo was created is an example of people recognizing that if I don't respond to the needs of this population, they might respond to me in a way that's unfavorable. You know, we had, when our school was built, we had a busload of people who just so happened to have the mayor's schedule for the week and followed the mayor everywhere he went at that time. And, you know, every, you know, plush building he would get out of, they would say, hey, well, Baloo looked like this for $8 million or for $60 million. And another bus found out the chancellor's schedule and they followed her everywhere she went and said, well, our school looked this great for that. Because, you know, my children's families aren't playing tennis with the editor of the Washington Post. Right. They don't get invited to the teas with the council members. So, you know, we didn't have the access in those private moments that most people with privilege have, quite frankly. So my families began to understand that, you know, if I make sure you recognize that what you do on this decision, I'm going to remember when it's time for me to decide who serves me, then people are going to respond to you a little differently.
Right.
And so with lots of communities, the thing that I push is no matter how many dollars, you know, so-and-so donates to whoever's campaign, that guy votes once just like you do. But with, you know, with 74,000 people in a community who pretty much have a consensus on how they feel about issues, if we just get you to come out and cast your ballot to a greater degree than the 8% that normally comes out, you have a dramatic impact, not just on who's the mayor, but on who's every at-large council member as well.
Right.
You pretty much still have the power in the district if you put your feet to the polls.
Right.
You know, so really, with every program that we engage in, we always make sure we give a certain amount of voter education because, you know, like I told my families when we got our new building is that, you know, this isn't going to happen for you or your child.
Right.
But some of you have nieces and nephews or little brothers or little sisters.
Yes.
And so the fight that we took on back in 2010, you know, the funny thing about it is I now see children who are in their 30s who are my students who say things like, I'm proud I got that building built. Yes, you did. I'm a company guy. They, you know, they pay me and it's moved this far, stop or I fire you. Like so I recognize to what degree I don't have the power. So the same way I led, you know, staff is the same way I try to work with a community in some level of leadership, which is by providing the information, which is FOIA-able, so I'm not breaking any rules, but here's the information.
Right.
And let me tell you what your actions can bring about.
Right. But no but.
Mm-hmm.
What you just referred to though was being willing to pay it forward, basically. But that's a willingness on the part of the constituent who says, who gets on that bus and follows the mayor, the chancellor around to get to put pressure on them to do something while they are in office,
right,
based on the threat, for want of a better term, of not putting those feet to the polls to keep them in office.
Right.
But the problems we're talking about, some of the problems we're talking about, are not capital development challenges,
true,
right? They're not budget approvals that will set in action a number,
true,
of bricks in the ground. They are changes in curriculum. They may be changes in personnel who teach said curricula, changes in mindset around education.
Absolutely.
They may be changes in access or thinking about access to care and changing in policies related to landlords, a whole bunch of things that can take longer potentially than a term.
I believe the amount of pressure you apply,
go ahead,
the amount of pressure that you apply could probably push things a little quicker.
Could push things quicker. So, and I think that that's the take home there, and what I want folks to really understand here is that a lot of times, especially in health, and from the health perspective, we say, well, it's going to take a long time for these changes to happen. And yes, we may take a long time for us to be able to measure some of these changes in outcomes. But if we're not putting some things in place now,
right,
we won't see changes down the road.
Right.
And maybe that won't be within this term of this elected official or the next term, but we still need to put those things in play right now. And then we need to put a holder in this very quickly, just to remind people of this, who we're having this great conversation with. This is Rockman Branch, the founder and managing partner at Inside Urban. And this is the Junctional Thinking podcast on Full Service Radio. We have been talking a bit about how to apply. So this is influencing, influencing in order to have impact, right? And getting people to understand what their authority is about. They may not be able to go to the tee or play tennis, but there are other things that they can and should be doing,
absolutely,
and engaging in on a regular basis. So going back to the top of our conversation about consistency, we can't just expect officials to be consistent,
right,
if we're not, as citizens, willing to also be consistent.
Exactly right.
And I think that that's, I don't think that that's forgotten by a lot of organizations,
right,
but I think that it is sometimes maybe forgotten by some of the people who those organizations serve. You have to be consistent too.
Well, the thing also is that, you know, the conversations I've had with certain organizations, one of the last things I did before I left the cabinet was we gave out grants. My office had just gotten grant making authority, and so we were giving out community grants to organizations who support various initiatives, you know, in communities of color. And one of the things that I often told organizations is that you have to also make sure that the people that you're serving are able to communicate out the benefit of what you do, and not just when it's time for the grant makers to come through and look at your program, but to always put out there the good work that you're doing so people can identify it readily, and that your residents then are growing and developing in their capacity to speak for themselves and speak to what they need specifically. And that's because a lot of times, to the point you brought up earlier, organizations, while they're thinking about the person that they're serving, they're forgetting one very specific point, which is to help that person to become an advocate for themselves. Because the self-advocacy of that individual that you're serving will always bring back a resource that you could use in support of them. You know what I mean? And most nonprofits, as I've worked in them, have always said, I'm in the business of putting myself out of business. So really, if I eradicate this issue, you know, I really want to own a coffee shop and chill out, wear cool t-shirts and jeans and play really great hip hop all day long. That's my dream. I got to finish this thing first. And then when I finish this thing, I'll be somewhere. I'll have written a book. I'll be in a coffee shop somewhere.
Yes.
You know, letting my hair grow out long and playing Tribe Called Quest.
There you go. Can I come?
Absolutely.
Can I be an occasional guest DJ?
Absolutely.
And just come in and do some stuff there? That would be fantastic. Let's talk a bit about the idea of having people become great advocates for what it is that they're not only being worked with on, like the programs or whatever it is, but What kind of patience does one need to have in order to instill that ability into, because they may not see themselves as advocates. They see themselves as advocates for the thing that they have a need for right. at that particular moment, but not necessarily for the long game that right. you were referring to. What kind of patience did you have to sort of exercise in getting people to understand their capacity in that regard?
I would have comparative conversations, not for the sake of building divide, but to give examples that this can be done. Specifically, I would often point to colleagues of mine who were principals at areas in, say, Northeast that were transitioning a lot quicker as far as demographic than maybe Southeast is, and how you would have 20-somethings at the local school meeting advocating for things, and then you ask them direct questions. They're like, no, I don't have a kid. I just bought this house down the block. I'm going to have kids in 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And then that means in 10 more years, they're going to be at this school. I need the school to start becoming what I want it to be now.
From now.
And so I would have that very honest conversation with our families, you know, in Southeast. And I always use the concept of sweat equity when you do this.
Yes.
You know, where you don't have a dollar, you know, you can put in an equal amount of sweat equity to get what you deserve. And that makes it a little harder for people to shake you off of something if you've attended every meeting, if you're listed in the bylaws, or if you're listed in the sign-in sheets and it shows that you've been here and doing the work. Not only does it cement you into a certain degree, but, you know, people being genuinely good at the end of the day, they recognize hard work. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it does get paid. Sometimes underpaid, but hard work does pay off at, you know, when you invest to this degree. And I think the biggest one was to make sure I painted the picture that, you know, this is for the child on your block who isn't your child, but the little girl down the street, she's going to be in this building if we get this done now.
Right.
You know, I always paint the picture of, you know, for our parents. I talk about, you know, nieces and nephews and grandchildren. You know, and for our children, I speak directly to, you know, what they can experience by the time they're an adult and what their children will receive as a result of that work. And you know, there are enough, normally there are enough seniors and elders in the room when I'm speaking that they can reference, you know, times before me. They can reference civil rights movements, to be quite honest. Here in D.C., enough of our senior community can address, you know, and remember the civil rights struggles when they talk about we had an action, we had an ask, and it was received
right.
as an impetus to kind of charge, you know, people to get back to work.
Right.
And I try to keep myself connected to that community because my dad told me a long time ago, you know, elders for council, youth for war. So, you know,
okay.
you always got to learn okay. something from the elders.
Elders for council, youth for war. Yeah. I like that. And that, so, but what about... I'm gonna use a reference that I don't know if everyone's necessarily gonna get, but the are you a Game of Thrones person?
Yes.
Okay. Thank goodness. Oh, you always got that question mark yes. as whether or not the person you're talking to is gonna get you. So there was a bank, mm-hmm. the Iron Bank,
right.
funding everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's corporations.
Yep.
What you've been referring to is the conversations with the people, right? The same people who are living in the various situations. Yeah. But then you also stand in this junction where you needed to be like everybody who was anybody in Game of Thrones needed to go and talk to the bank.
Yep.
You needed to go and talk to the Iron Bank folks. And the Iron Bank people were just about debt.
Mm-hmm.
You owe us. You will pay us back. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Right.
There's a new wave of opportunity coming into cities now, mm-hmm. the opportunity zones, as yeah. part of the Jobs Act of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And there are funds mm-hmm. specifically being developed and pulled together to invest in some of the very things that we've been talking right. about. But the conversations one might have with the fund managers and others who are investing is a slightly different conversation than one might have with the people mm-hmm. that you've been referring to.
Right.
As somebody who stands at that junction and mm-hmm. stands to want to leverage some of that resource in order to do the good that we've right. been talking about, how do you talk to the Iron Bank?
Because, and great question, and I thought the ending lacked a lot of Game of Thrones.
So. We won't even get into that. That's a whole other episode of this podcast. Yeah,
but left a lot to be desired.
A lot.
But ultimately, I think it's, so there's, I recognize that I probably think way left of lots of those who are working in the Opportunity Zone space.
Okay.
And recognizing that they're here for an investment, that they tend to reap an equity piece out of what they invest. Just try to make sure they understand who is the partner that they're working with, and what the investment looks like and how that over time is going to transfer. It's not a quick fix. So, you know, it's not fast money, but it's going to be long money when you invest in a population who's only been proven to generate cash historically.
Right.
You know, there are studies that talk about the amount of money that we spend at the, you know, small grocery stores or fast food joints in Ward 7 and 8. It's in excess of $130 million a year.
Right.
So there's money moving through these communities, but none of it stays.
Right.
The Opportunity Zone conversation is just how do we work to a place where you see some of this money stay with the residents of this community who have proven that they're already going to spend money anyway.
Right.
But how do we keep some of it flowing through the community, through business ownership, through business partnerships, so that the community then grows as well.
And the community can thrive, and people who are investing can do well and do good, but do good for the long run. This has been a great conversation, Rahman. I really appreciate you coming in. Again, we've been joined by Rahman Branch, the founder and managing partner at Inside Urban. Look him up, just connect. Whatever it is, that his spaces are so diverse that I feel like just about anything that anybody wants to get into out there, he could probably facilitate or might be able to make use of himself, because he's a perpetual learner, a great listener, somebody who is really engaged in a number of different impact-oriented things here in the district. So I appreciate you, sir, for taking the time.
Thank you, brother.
Once again, this is Pierre Vigilance, your host, Junctional Thinking on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C., and we will see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.